From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The stock market is undergoing wild fluctuations at a time when more Americans than ever are investing. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Daniel Gross about why the percentage of Americans holding stock has doubled in the past decade and how that has affected Wall Street and politics. Gross is the author of the new book, Bull Run. Also, we meet Barry Blaustein, director of a new documentary about wrestling. He used to write for Saturday Night Live and co-created several of Eddie Murphy's characters. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about Bohemian New York in the early 20th century. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal appeals court in Miami has issued a temporary order that Elian Gonzalez not be removed from the United States until the court has time to review an emergency petition filed by the boy's great-uncle, Lázaro Gonzalez. Lázaro Gonzalez ignored a government order that he turn the boy over to the custody of his father today, telling supporters in Miami's Little Havana neighborhood that the six-year-old boy will have to be taken from him by force. Lázaro Gonzalez and his family have resisted giving the boy up ever since Elian was found clinging to an inner tube off the Florida coast in November. The Justice Department said today that it has agreed to wait to reclaim the boy until the appeals court has reviewed Lázaro Gonzalez's petition, a matter that could take another 3 or 4 days. In its final action before leaving for the Easter recess, the Senate has approved a $1.8 trillion budget resolution. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The budget resolution sets out Republican priorities for this election year: more defense spending, more education spending, and $150 billion in tax cuts. The Senate vote followed a similar party-line vote in the House. Senate Budget Chairman Pete Domenici dismissed Democratic complaints about the GOP's emphasis on tax relief.
If we don't hold spending, except for high-priority items like defense, education, science, NIH, and the like, then American people, married couples of America, you can say goodbye to any tax relief as it might affect you.
President Clinton has complained that the budget plan defies common sense, but this resolution does not go to the White House for a signature. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Police in Washington, D.C. have arrested 7 protesters in town to disrupt this weekend's meetings of officials from the World Bank and IMF. NPR's Guy Raz reports.
Police raided a house in the Adams Morgan District last night and found hundreds of chains, gas masks, and PVC tubes. Protesters plan to use the hardware to create a sleeping dragon, a human barricade where thick tubes and chains link protesters. The barricades could prevent officials meeting at the IMF and World Bank from entering the proceedings. D.C. Police Chief Charles Ramsey said the arrests are a precautionary measure.
People don't have a right just to come here and chain themselves together and block traffic and prevent people from having meetings.
This particular kind of chain makes it difficult for police to safely disperse crowds. In order to break the link, they must saw through the tubing. Leaders from the National Lawyers Guild were swift to denounce the arrests, calling them a serious violation of the protesters' constitutional rights. Guy Raz, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow Industrials lost 202 points today to close at 10,924 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The United Nations Civil Administration in Kosovo is calling on European countries to be less hasty in pushing Kosovars back home. 6 plane loads of deportees have arrived in Kosovo in the last 2 days. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from Pristina.
Countries like Switzerland or Germany are taking advantage of the current peace here to send back wartime refugees as well as longtime illegal immigrants from Kosovo. One dazed young man just off a plane from Switzerland described being woken up, handcuffed, imprisoned for a day, and bundled onto the plane, where he said everyone, even an old woman, was handcuffed and under guard. The UN Civil Administration has signed agreements allowing host countries to send Kosovars back, spokeswoman Susan Manuel.
We've asked for the countries to pace their returns so that we may get a total of 100,000 to 150,000 returnees this year.
In an open letter today, UN Administrator Bernard Kouchner warned that too many repatriations could swamp the fragile peace here. He called on host countries to help reintegrate returnees. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Pristina.
South Carolina's NAACP has rejected a state Senate plan to remove the Confederate flag from the state house dome. The state Senate voted overwhelmingly yesterday to remove the flag from the dome and from the House and Senate chambers. In an effort to satisfy people who regard the flag as part of the state's heritage, the measure called for the flag to be flown behind a monument to Confederate soldiers that's located in front of the state house. The NAACP said the symbol is still too visible and that the new location still implies that it's an official state flag. The NASDAQ lost 92 points today to close at 3,676. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The fluctuating stock market has been taking investors on a wild ride, and the number of Americans with queasy stomachs is much higher than it would have been even a decade ago. In 1990, only 23% of adult Americans owned stock or mutual funds. By the end of the decade, the figure had doubled. My guest, Daniel Gross, no relation, is the author of the new book Bull Run, about Wall Street and the new politics of personal finance. He's a journalist who has written about business and politics for The Washington Post, The New Republic, and Investment News. I spoke with him yesterday, which was the sixth worst day in the history of the NASDAQ, the composite index of technology stocks. It was down 25% from the height it had reached March 10th. In a recent New York Times op-ed piece, Gross wrote that the wild fluctuations in the market doesn't mean the bull market is over, but the bull run might have ended for companies using the Internet to deliver goods, services, or content. I asked what led him to that conclusion.
A lot of the individual stocks, especially individual Internet stocks, companies that came public, say they came public at 10 or 15, and in their first week there was such demand that they flew up to 50, 60, 70. A lot of those stocks are now back in the single digits. So there have been near catastrophic losses in some of these companies. Companies like DrCoop.com, which is now trading at about 3. CD Now, which sells compact discs over the internet, also at around 3. Online grocers like Peapod, also down to about 3 or 4. And when a stock gets in that level, it really inhibits the ability to either sell more stock to the public or to make an acquisition using that stock, which has been the traditional means of growth and expansion for internet companies.
Do you think that investors are becoming more skeptical of companies that haven't shown profits?
Certainly. If there's anything that the action in the last few months, and it's not the last week, it's the last 3 or 4 months, it's that the gospel that, you had to spend money to make money, and the rationale, the reason for being of a lot of these internet companies was, we're going to raise a lot of money from the public, plow it into marketing and advertising, and therefore losses in the short term are acceptable because we're building a brand, we're establishing a presence. The market bought into that for a couple years. In the last few months, however, as companies have begun running low on cash, as they've become more desperate for new capital, and as they have failed to show results from a lot of this spending, institutional investors like mutual funds have really soured on the whole sector, and the individual investors who provided so much of the trading activity in these stocks have also left and gone on to the new thing, which is, business-to-business internet companies.
What are business-to-business internet companies?
As opposed, the first internet companies that came public, the Amazon.coms, America Onlines, these are business-to-consumer, B2C. They are businesses that are selling products or services to consumers. It's obviously an expensive proposition because you're shipping one book at a time. You have to spend a lot on kind of mass marketing. The new thing has been business-to-business companies that sell their products and services to other businesses. That is now thought to be more profitable, more viable in the long term than many of these business-to-consumer companies.
What do you think the wild fluctuations in the stock market in the past couple of weeks have to say about the new high-tech stocks versus the old economy stocks? I mean, for such a long time, people were saying, oh, the old economy is dead. It's all the vitality is in the new economy, the high-tech stocks. And that seems to be reversing a little bit in the past couple of weeks.
I think what it shows, and this is part of the democratization of money, is the ease with which people can move money around. Transaction costs for trading stocks or trading money in and out of mutual funds are very low, and people have the ability to log on to their brokerage site or their bank and move money around very quickly, very easily. You don't have to call a broker anymore to do it. And when you see when the NASDAQ goes up 20%, then down 20%, and the people on television are talking about money moving into different sectors. You know, today it's moving into the pharmaceuticals. Tomorrow it's moving into paper companies. What this shows is the great ability of individuals and institutions to move money in and out of sectors, markets, individual stocks very quickly and very cheaply. People are not taking their money out of the market and putting it in an interest-bearing checking account or under their mattress as they did, you know, back in the 1930s. People have a lot of faith in the stock market as an entity. What you're seeing is more a change of fortunes of different sectors relative to one another.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Gross. He's the author of the new book, Bull Run, Wall Street, the Democrats, and the New Politics of Personal Finance. Your new book is about what you describe as the democratization of money. Would you explain that expression for us?
Sure. It has two meanings. The first is democratization with a small d, and I think everybody is aware of these manifestations. What I'm talking about is the vast expansion of the shareholding population, the explosion of the financial media, the ability to trade stocks on the internet, the notion of the markets as a shared public space that are accessible not only to the rich, but also to the middle class. And so that's the democratization of money or the markets with a small d. This has been accompanied by the democratization of the markets with a big D, by which I mean that the Democratic Party, historically an antagonist towards Wall Street and the markets, has, in the 1990s, come to love and embrace the markets. And in return, the markets and Wall Street have come to love and embrace the Democratic Party, in particular, the Clinton administration.
What are some of the things that changed in the 90s pertaining to who invests and how they invest that you think changed the shape of Wall Street?
In the 90s, there has been a vast explosion in the sheer size of the investing public. In 1990, about 23% of American households had mutual funds. Today, it's probably close to half. And the interest in stock markets has grown at every income level, from the very wealthy, the upper middle class, obviously not so much in the working classes or lower income levels. But the interest at every level in investing in the market has grown because people are pursuing their retirement. They are increasingly empowered to control their own financial destiny. In other words, it used to be you went to work for a company, they set up the pension for you, they made the donations, they decided where the money went. Now with increased mobility, the growth of 401ks, individuals are not only being asked to, but they're in many cases being forced to make those decisions about what is done with their retirement money. So that has been a main factor.
By the way, you know, in talking about how people have money tied up in the market through their retirement funds and have become more interested in the market as a result of that, your father is a good example of that. Tell us about your father.
Well, I use the example of my parents. My father was an English professor at Michigan State University. He began working there in 1966, and as was probably typical of people of his generation and profession, had comparatively little interest in what was going on in the stock market. Every year, however, he and Michigan State University made contributions to TIAA-CREF. And over the last 34 years, those small contributions, which were taken out of a modest salary, ballooned in size to the point where I believe, you know, my parents woke up one day in the mid-90s and realized they were substantial stockholders. And this is a process that has repeated itself countless times. At TIAA CREF, some 32,000 of their members have assets over $1 million, and 120,000 have assets over $500,000 in the pension fund alone. So these are a lot of social scientists out there who have gotten rather wealthy off the 90s bull market.
My guest is Daniel Gross. His new book is called Bull Run, Wall Street, the Democrats, and the New Politics of Personal Finance. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Daniel Gross. He writes about Wall Street and personal finance. He has a new book called Bull Run, Wall Street, the Democrats, and the New Politics of Personal Finance. Let's talk about how changes in Wall Street have affected politics. Now that Wall Street is of interest to so many more people are invested in the market, how is that affecting politics?
In the 80s, there was a very stark divide. Wall Street equals wealth, equals Reagan Republicans, and Democrats were arrayed against that alliance. And what you've seen in the 90s, and it's been a slow but steady transformation with every passing year, that the Clinton administration has become more invested, not only probably personally, but politically in the markets. And as the markets have expanded, as they became more accessible, as they became more populous, it made more sense for a Democratic president to embrace them, to want them to do well. Not just because he was in office, but because the retirement funds of so many people and so many Democratic constituents, labor unions, teachers, college professors, because so much of their money is in the market, it behooves a Democrat as much as it does a Republican to worry about the health and stability of the markets.
How has the new alliance between Wall Street and the Democrats affected the Republican Party?
I think it's affected them negatively. Historically, the Republicans were the party aligned with Wall Street. And as the Democratic Party has become more moderate, perhaps more conservative, more aligned with Wall Street in its worldview and outlook, the Republican Party, over the course of the 90s, has gone in the opposite direction. With each passing election, the congressional Republicans have become more populist, more Southern, more skeptical of issues like free trade, the global financial architecture, the notion of businesses being in business to make a profit versus moral concerns. And so you've seen that there's been a disconnect both politically and culturally between the congressional leadership and Wall Street. It used to be that a lot of the, what we used to call the Rockefeller Republicans, who were primarily Northeastern and socially moderate, who became involved in politics, were cut from the same cloth as the people who ran Wall Street firms. They went to the same prep schools, the same Ivy League universities. Now it's the Democrats who are more from that cloth, and the Republicans, people like Trent Lott, Dick Armey, these are people who want nothing to do with the East Coast establishment and who have very little in common culturally or socially or politically with the wealthy people who run Wall Street firms today.
What are some of the things that you think the Clinton administration did that were most pleasing to investors?
Part of it was a mindset. In the early year, in 1993, there were these sort of epic internal battles between the left advisors, people like Paul Begala and George Stephanopoulos. And, you know, this has all been documented very well in various memoirs. the battle was between the left and the kind of more moderate Wall Street-oriented advisors like Robert Rubin. As to how the administration should approach Wall Street and the budget deficit and Alan Greenspan and the prerogatives of the bond market. And the outcome was that in 1993, Clinton proposed a budget that began to reduce the deficit. And this was over the objections of many people in the more liberal wing in the White House. That sent a message early on that the Clinton administration was very interested in what Wall Street and the public markets thought about their policies, and that mindset came to dominate more and more as the years went by. In addition, there's nothing Wall Street hates more than instability, and there have been various periods, the Mexico crisis of late 94, early 95, the Asian crises and Russian crises of 97 and 98, and these were instances in which members of the Clinton administration really took the lead in working with the IMF and the World Bank to orchestrate these bailouts of first Mexico and then the Asian countries and Russia. At the same time the Clinton administration was working to do this, you had the Republicans in Congress who were actively seeking to undermine that. And whatever the merits of any of those bailout programs were, they seemed to work in that they restored stability. So the Clinton administration, because people like Robert Rubin, who had been the chairman of Goldman Sachs and was the Treasury Secretary for many years, because of his worldview and his interest in understanding what Wall Street needed and wanted, the administration took actions to help restore stability to the markets time and again.
Do you think the phenomenon that you describe as the democratization of money might really change if the stock market has a serious fall, that people might feel burned and that the trend we saw in the 90s might reverse itself?
Well, for that to happen, there would have to be a truly serious fall. I mean, if you go back to 1992, the Dow is up about 3.5 times, and the NASDAQ is still up at least 5 times. So in order for people to feel as if they, as long-term investors, have lost money, we would really have to have a catastrophic fall. The other thing is that I think people have been so conditioned by the financial media that you buy and you hold for the long term. And so many of today's investors, especially those who are investing in pension funds, are simply having a certain amount deducted from their paycheck every week or every month. So it's not as if there were a severe pullback, I don't think everybody or a large part of the population would simply stop investing. Most people have longer time horizons. And in addition, as we've seen, and it happens very quickly, that when one sector or area falls out of favor, money quickly moves to other sectors, and Wall Street still benefits from that. In other words, if U.S. stocks were seen as poor performers, people would start investing in European stocks or Asian stocks, or they would buy mutual funds that specialize in bonds. Either way, people would still be invested, they would still be trading, and they would still be watching what happens in the market. So I don't think that it is likely to kind of disappear as a force or even subside, even if there is a substantial correction.
A lot more people are invested in the stock market than ever before, but there's still a very large percentage of the American public that is not. What about them?
That remains one of the challenges. And as with everything else that makes American lives better, whether it's home ownership or health insurance, the lower income people of this country have not participated in the bull market to the extent that the wealthier have. Now, a fair number of working class people, people who are members of unions or people who are civil servants or teachers or janitors, they have been participating through their pension funds. They may not have brokerage accounts, but they are all invested because money is being invested on their behalf by these very large institutions. That said, there are obviously there's a very large part of the population that is not invested in the market, and there have been proposals, government proposals, in fact, to change that namely the whole idea of investing Social Security funds in the market. If that were actually to happen, then anybody who has worked on the books would become a shareholder to a very small degree. And of course, you know, I think that's in some ways a very dangerous proposal, and obviously a very controversial one, and one that I think a lot of people on the left oppose. But in some senses, that would represent the ultimate in the democratization of money, because it would instantly expand the shareholder population to include all kinds of people who had not been included before.
Well, sure, everybody would be included on it, but everybody would be vulnerable in a way that they hadn't before, because, you know, your retirement money would be completely tied to the market. So if something bad happened, then
well,
what?
I think even the most aggressive proposals call for only a portion of the funds or a small portion of the total funds to be invested in the stock market. So you wouldn't necessarily have the prospect of people being wiped out. I'm just saying that it's ironic that that the proposal that would help kind of socialize ownership of American companies greater is one that started off life as a, you know, came from the fringes of the right wing and has become pretty mainstream in a matter of a few years. And that's another sign of this notion that the markets are a almost, you know, friendly, almost benign force in our society. In the 80s, if anybody stood up and said, let's put Social Security funds in the stock market, I think they would have disappeared from view rather quickly.
Daniel Gross, have you been investing in the market for a long time?
About 4 years.
That's not that long.
If I was more successful at investing, I wouldn't be writing books.
Right. Okay, fair enough. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Gross is the author of the new book, Bull Run, Wall Street, the Democrats, and the New Politics of Personal Finance. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Time, on newsstands April 17th, Time magazine presents an edition entitled How to Save the Earth. Information available, time.com. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. And from Island Records Def Jam Music Group, featuring I Am Shelby Lynn, from new recording artist Shelby Lynn. Available in stores or on the web, www.islanddefjam.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, a new documentary about wrestling called Beyond the Mat. We talk with director Barry Blaustein, who used to write for Eddie Murphy on Saturday Night Live and now co-writes movies for Murphy. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about the history of New York's Greenwich Village. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wrestling, the spectacle, the business, the fake drama, the often real pain and injury, and the performers' lives in and out of the ring is the subject of the new documentary Beyond the Mat. My guest is the director, Barry Blaustein. He's a lifelong wrestling fan who is best known as a comedy writer. He's a former head writer for Saturday Night Live and co-created several of Eddie Murphy's characters. He also co-wrote several of Murphy's movies. In Beyond the Mat, Blaustein takes us behind the scenes of the most successful wrestling organization, the WWF, the World Wrestling Federation. He shows how the characters are created and how the matches are scripted. In this scene, he takes us into the office of the WWF's owner, Vince McMahon, as McMahon meets with a newcomer to the WWF, Darren Drozdov. McMahon is telling Drozdov that the WWF has created a character for Drozdov that exploits his unusual ability to vomit on cue.
Quite frankly, what we've come up with is, since you are able to regurgitate, you know, on command, it just seems to me that it's pretty logical that you should be puke, you know. puke has a nice connotation to it. You know, I mean, it's like you got animal, you got hawk, you got puke, you know. And it shouldn't be just plain puke, it should be puke, you know. So after you've regurgitated on one of your opponents or on the referee itself, then, of course, the ring announcer would, you know, then say your name.
Okay.
And then again, it's like, since you've got the fundamentals and so forth, and I think you're ready to go with it, I think that, you know, puke is good. I think puke is nice.
See, I've never heard that. That's great.
Yeah. No, it's right.
Everybody yeah. always gives me stuff about it. That's good.
No, it fits the WWF attitude.
Barry Blaustein, how far did Darren Drozdov get with the puke persona?
The puke persona never caught on because... And I didn't think it would ever get over because Darren could not really puke on cue. He needed about 10, 15 minutes. And so he couldn't turn it on and off like a faucet. So he never was able to throw up on opponents at will, which is, I think, his opponents are grateful, and as a wrestling fan, I'm grateful. Darren started to make it. Unfortunately, what happened about 3 weeks after I finished the movie last October, Darren was involved in a wrestling match for the WWF in Nassau Coliseum. And either one of the other wrestlers slipped or Darren didn't tuck his head the correct way, and Darren was injured. He is paralyzed now. He is paraplegic, and doctors hope that one day he might be able to walk again. So it just shows even casual moves, if not done right, there can be severe injury.
The big money and muscle behind wrestling is the WWF, the World Wrestling Federation. And you describe it as being worth more now than the New York Rangers, the Knicks, and the Mets combined. The WWF has been in the McMahon family for how many generations?
Four generations.
How did Vince McMahon change the WWF after he took it over from his father?
Well, previous to Vince McMahon taking over the WWF, wrestling in the United States was run by separate families. And it's much like The Godfather. Different families ran different regions. So one family ran the Northeast. One family ran the Southeast. One family ran the West, and so on and so forth. And within each individual state, you were given, the families would say, okay, now you can run this promotion in this town or in this part of the state. Once Vince took over, there are different theories. One is that the other promoters were going to try to take over Vince's territory, which was the very profitable Northeast territory. The other, that Vince saw the advent of cable and realized wrestling could go national. So Vince went into these smaller territories, took the talent, closed down these smaller promoters, and thus took wrestling from being a regional business to a national and then international business.
You have a short scene in your documentary in which there's a staff writer talking to one of the wrestlers, and he's basically telling her that she has to act like her back really hurts. And he says, sell the back to the point that we don't feel that you'll be able to compete.
Right.
How much of the storylines are actually scripted by the writers before the matches?
Oh, the storylines are totally scripted before the matches by writers. By writers, and some wrestlers are able to go in there and improvise and add to their storylines. It's much like a director and an actor. Sometimes the wrestler adds a whole bunch of different movements and nuances to it. But the storyline is determined before they go in there.
You know, there are so many fake injuries in wrestling and fake pain in wrestling that it's, I think, sometimes hard for fans to tell when there's a real accident that has happened and someone when someone is genuinely, seriously hurt. I suppose that the people who are wrestling, like the opponents and the referees and all that, can tell the difference right away?
Yes, they know right away. They'll say to somebody, I'm hurt, or just roll over me, or just pin me right now. I can't go any further. You know, if you're really up close in a wrestling match, when there's a really violent move and those two guys lock, invariably one will say to the other, are you okay? Are you okay? So they're always checking out for each other's health.
And they're mic'd in a way so that the mics don't pick that up?
Right. Well, they're not mic'd at all. Mm-hmm. If they were mic'd, it would ruin wrestling.
Because they wouldn't be able to give these messages to each other?
They wouldn't be able to. They're constantly talking with each other in the ring. When they get in a headlock or what they call a rest hold, they're talking to each other what the next couple of moves they're going to do.
What are the health benefits like for wrestlers now?
Wrestlers have no health benefits whatsoever. They have no pension plans. It's very, very hard for them to get any sort of medical insurance.
And this is in all the wrestling groups?
All the wrestling groups. If a wrestler is injured in the ring, generally, for example, Darren Drozdov, Vince McMahon is paying for everything. And if a wrestler is injured while in the ring, Vince will usually pay for it.
You spent a considerable amount of time in your wrestling documentary with Mick Foley, who's, you know, one of today's best-known wrestlers, and he's had a book that's been on the bestseller list for quite a while. Why did you choose him as one of the centers of the movie? What does he represent to you?
Well, to me, Mick is very atypical of a lot of wrestlers. He's the most articulate of the wrestlers. He's probably one of the most intelligent of them. A college professor of his told me, who's now head of the media department at Syracuse University, has told me that in 25 years of teaching, Mick is one of the two brightest people he's ever met. And Mick is able, what interests me about Mick is Mick plays a very violent, sadistic character in the ring. Outside the ring, he's extremely peaceful. And he's someone who's able to leave his character in the ring. And what also interests me very much about Mick is that he's very much a family man. And he's trying to keep his family together and raise his two children. He's very devoted to them. And I thought that was an interesting dichotomy. I mean, I would speak to Mick on the phone, and this is when his children were very young. And here you have this big, bruising guy. And he would just be on the phone, and he would be calling to his son, Dewey, that's a timeout, that's a timeout. And so it really, that dichotomy interests me tremendously.
What's his specialty in the ring?
Specialty is taking punishment. There's never been anyone in the history of wrestling who's received more punishment than Mick.
Now, does his family always know which punishment is scripted and when he's hurt for real?
He'll tell his children, he'll tell his family, you know, daddy's really not going to get hurt. His children no longer believe him because they get terrified when they see it. That's one of the reasons Mick is thinking of quitting, because I don't think he thinks physically he can't do it anymore, emotionally he can't do it anymore, and I think he wonders about the effect of it on his family. And he wants to put that to an end.
He had a serious accident, which you document in your movie. Why don't you describe it?
Well, what happened is Mick was in a match called Hell in a Cell, and there was, which is where two wrestlers climb on top of about a 20-foot cage. And there was a spot where Mick jumped off the cage onto a table. And as horrendous as that was actually a planned thing. Then Mick got back on top of the cage, and another wrestler threw him down on top of the cage, and the cage accidentally broke open, and it sent Mick about 20 feet sprawling right onto his back, which is a miracle, did not kill Mick.
What did happen?
He lied there unconscious for a while, and he got up, and then he wrestled again. The other wrestler told me, I thought I had actually killed him. And Mick got up. You look at the film, you see he has a total dazed look in his eye. The other wrestler says, this is ending now. And they ended the match. And he had some very severe broken bones from it, but it's just a miracle and a tribute to his body structure that he's not paraplegic or dead now.
And he's been wrestling since that?
He's been wrestling since then. He took about a week off and started wrestling again. These guys have no off season. These aren't like other athletes or performers. They wrestle 250 nights a year. So that's one of the things, they're never home.
Now, the WWF went public last year.
Right.
They're now a publicly held company in the stock market. How did that affect money and operations in the organization?
It would be hard to say. I know it made Vince McMahon a lot richer man than he was the day before it went public. So I don't know. There was more influx of money into the company, but it's even without the public offering. I think I think Vince knows wrestling at its peak popularity, and it was a wise business decision.
While we're talking about money and merchandising, I know that the WWF won't let you advertise your movie within their wrestling programs. What reason did they give you for that?
Because I wouldn't sell the movie to the WWF. When I approached the WWF about filming there, they offered to triple my budget. I turned them down. I was making the movie, they offered to buy it, invest in it. When I showed them the movie, they wanted to buy the film. And the reason I did not want them to buy the film or to invest in the film is because, as a documentarian, you have to keep a certain amount of independence. And you can't have a subject matter be an investor in the film. So I turned them down, and that Vince McMahon operates in a world where he very rarely hears the word no. And he's used to bullying people around. Unfortunately, I'm not one of his wrestlers, and I have a life outside of wrestling, thank God. And I just wouldn't acquiesce to Vince's demands. The scary part of it is this. Vince also put pressure on USA, UPN, and Chris Kraft Station Group not to advertise the movie on any show on their networks. So I was not only restricted from advertising on the wrestling shows, I was restricted from advertising on any show on their networks. And, it very much hurt us our first week. An analogy might be the NFL was not very happy with the Oliver Stone movie on any given Sunday. Yet they did not put pressure on CBS and Fox not to run ads for the movie.
Barry Blaustein is my guest. He directed the new wrestling documentary Beyond the Mat. He's also former head writer and supervising producer for Saturday Night Live. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barry Blaustein. He directed the new documentary about wrestling called Beyond the Mat. I want to get to a different part of your career.
Sure.
You could tell me how many years that you were?
3 years for Saturday Night Live.
As head writer?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't hired as a head writer, but my partner and I, David Sheffield, became head writers and supervising producers of the show.
And I know you worked a lot with Eddie Murphy. What characters did you create for him?
We created with Eddie Buckwheat, Mr. Robinson, Gumby, Velvet Jones, whole bunch of other stuff.
Mr. Robinson was Mr. Robinson's neighborhood?
Yes. Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. Yes, Mr. Robinson's neighborhood.
Right, based on Mr. Rogers. It was this describe the character.
Well, it's just basically Eddie's version of Mr. Rogers. And I have to say, one of the bizarrest things that ever happened, Mr. Rogers actually came up to the offices one day, and he actually talks like Mr. Rogers, and the sweater, and is basically saying, "You've had your fun. Now stop doing the sketches."
Did he really say that?
Yeah. we were tired of doing them anyway. And I said, we're trying to get him to come on and actually say, "Can you say the word lawsuit?" And he wouldn't do it.
Describe the character a little more for our listeners who have either forgotten.
Well, it was an inner city version of Mr. Rogers, and how Mr. Rogers deals with certain things in his neighborhood. Mr. Robinson dealt with things in the inner city neighborhood.
For example?
Not paying his rent, drug dealing, crime, being held up, those sort of things.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mad? Won't you be mad? Won't you be my neighbor? Hello, boys and girls. You know Christmas is a special time in Mr. Robinson's neighborhood. It's a time for giving. And look what Mr. Landlord gave me. It's an eviction notice. Well, that's why Mr. Robinson has to wear this Santa Claus suit to sneak in and out of his building. But it just isn't a disguise, boys and girls, because when I add this little kettle here, and when I add this little bell, it becomes a small business. Yes, Christmas is a season for giving and for taking. And with this little operation, I figure I'll be taking in about $300 or $400 a day. Oh, why must Christmas come but once a year?
Was it ever an issue with Eddie Murphy or with other people on the show that white writers were helping to create these black characters for him, characters that were assumed to express his point of view as a black man?
When I write for Eddie, when Dave and I write for Eddie, and we're both proud white men, that we're just writing these characters. These characters, I'm not writing them. This is the black experience that I'm writing. I'm writing these characters' experience. And I don't ever say I'm writing that whole black experience. But Eddie's never had a problem with it whatsoever.
Now, I read a long time ago, I think, that Eddie Murphy grew up in a part of Long Island that had a large Jewish community, so that he was exposed to a lot of Jewish people when he was growing up. And I remember, you can tell me if this is true or not, but I remember one character that he did was this elderly, cranky Jewish guy who'd go like, "Oi, I'll eat it anyways."
Right. He could do that. I think being around show business, he got that exposure. Eddie
sure.
grew up in Roosevelt, which is actually mostly black community.
I see.
But, and I grew up about 15 miles away from Eddie, and Eddie used to always say, "We used to come to your town and steal bicycles." And I had my bike stolen as a kid, so I've always accused him of having my bike. But Eddie can do Jews incredibly well, you know, so.
Did you work on that elderly cranky guy with him?
Yeah, we did. In Coming to America, he did an old elderly Jew in a barbershop. So, yeah, I did a little of that. But it was really strange. I was writing that. Dave and I were writing that. We were writing in Coming to America, a bunch of elderly black barbers, and there's an elderly Jewish customer in there, too. And it was very easy to write, maybe because we've been around 80, to write that dialogue. And when it came to actually write, I needed a line that the elderly Jew would say. I called up my father, who's an elderly Jew, and asked him, what would he say? What would somebody say here at this point? And which was strange because I'm Jewish, so I should know this better. But I don't.
Give us a sense of what the process was like for writing sketches when you were working with him on Saturday Night Live.
Well, you're up real late. You're never home. Most of the stuff was done about 3 in the morning. And you'd be sitting around, and invariably, the best way of coming up with comedy, you're forever stuck if you sit around going, "Now, what would be funny? What would be funny?" Because you're never going to come up with something. You just talk about life experiences and things that happen to you, and you ever meet this kind of person, and then, you know, then you'll go off from there and you'll hit on something that's humorous. Sometimes there'll be stuff in the news. You know, the Jesse Jackson dude in Hymietown. That was obviously, I read that and I thought, well, this is, you know, ripe for satire.
Did you work on any of the Stevie Wonder impressions?
Oh, yeah, sure. We did them all, yeah.
Uh-huh.
We did Ebony and Ivory, where he sang with Frank Sinatra. And I think the first one we did was Stevie Wonder as Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof.
Was I don't think
time
I saw that.
Oh, yeah. I think it was the first time he did it on the air. It was a time when they were having, like, different people, you know, to be Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof. And so he came out and did If I Was a Rich Man. It was pretty funny. So we've done a lot of the Stevie Wonder stuff. And we worked with Stevie Wonder.
Right.
That was the best part. That was my favorite week on Saturday Night Live. Because, you know, I tend not to be starstruck, especially you meet most stars and you just have extreme disappointment. But I remember Stevie Wonder coming in and we're talking about sitting down with him about 2-3 hours in the office. And he's very loose. He's very funny. And we actually were making fun of other blind performers. And we were saying, let's do something where Jose Feliciano can really see and other people. And we're sitting around talking, and he left the room, and suddenly it hit me. It was like, wow, I was just talking with Stevie Wonder for 3 hours. So there's something, you know, when people describe Stevie Wonder, they always go, he's very spiritual and all that. And I was like, come on, give me a break. And I call my wife up, and I go, I was just with Stevie Wonder, and she goes, what's he like? And I go, you know, he's very spiritual. You get this feeling. So he does. He's very spiritual.
Well, do you have a favorite of the sketches you worked on with Eddie Murphy in the Saturday Night Live era?
I think my favorite is when we killed Buckwheat.
Uh-huh.
Because that turned into a 3-part thing, and each one was sort of a takeoff on media coverage of the news. One was off... first one was sort of pointing at the media for the coverage of the Reagan assassination, which had just happened recently, the assassination attempt. And the other one had to deal with Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. and the last one had to deal with the, eyewitnesses coming out of nowhere, people coming, the national inquirization of the news.
Right.
So those were my favorites. I liked when Eddie did Jesse Jackson, and he sang a song called "Hymie Town" right after, right after Jesse Jackson said that. And then we got a call from Jesse Jackson asking to write for him.
That you should write for Jesse Jackson?
Yeah.
Did you?
No.
Why not? Was it tempting at all?
It was kind of tempting. I don't know. There's a lot I admire about Jesse Jackson. There's a lot I stay away from politicians. Something about them I don't trust.
Do you not want to be used for their political?
No, I don't want. Yeah, I don't want to be used at all. I once was approached to write for somebody who's I won't mention who it is, but it's from a famous political family, and I said, well, what do they stand for? What does this particular person stand for? And they said, oh, don't worry. He stands for everything you stand for. And I'm going, wait a second. I don't even know what I stand for. So I think it's real dangerous. You know, if I'm going to write for somebody, there are politicians I would write for. But they have to be somebody that I totally agree with or agree with on most things.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Barry Blaustein directed the new wrestling documentary Beyond the Mat. He's former head writer for Saturday Night Live. Coming up, a new book about the history of New York's Greenwich Village. This is Fresh Air. The popular image of New York City's Greenwich Village in the early years of the 20th century is that of a bohemian brigadoon where free love and fervent debates about politics and art flourished for a time. But in her new book, American Moderns, Bohemian New York and the Creation of a New Century, cultural historian Christine Stanzel says that those giddy bohemians did more than just establish Greenwich Village as a tourist attraction. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Historian Christine Stanzel's new book on Greenwich Village from 1890 to the end of the First World War is called American Moderns, and it's loaded with great coming to New York stories. But nobody's is more blissful than that of the anarchist Emma Goldman. Lured away from a deadening marriage in Rochester, New York, by tales of feminist new women who were staking out independent lives in Manhattan, Goldman landed in the city where she knew no one on a Sunday in 1889. That first day, she walked into a Lower East Side cafe where she met Alexander Berkman, best known as the failed assassin of industrialist Henry Clay Frick. Berkman would become Goldman's lover and her lifelong comrade, and that evening he took her to a meeting of leading anarchists. Goldman was home. Of course, the beginnings of Goldman's public life in New York have been well chronicled. So have the lives of her fellow Greenwich Village bohemians, people like the radical writer John Reed, glamorous patron of the arts Mabel Dodge, birth control activist Margaret Sanger, and the educational reformer Randolph Bourne. In American Moderns, however, Stanzel wants to combat some charming but distorting tourist trade myths that have twined around these bohemians, their comrades, and Greenwich Village itself. There's the prevailing assumption that the village, somewhere around 1910, just began attracting artists and revolutionaries who all, independently, somehow stumbled into the great gravitational pull of its winding streets, exotic restaurants, and cheap apartments. But as the Goldman Odyssey suggests, and Stanzel vividly documents, there exists a prehistory to the heyday of the village in the Lower East Side. During the turn of the century, intellectually curious American-born young people, eager to escape a late Victorian atmosphere of ennui, began leaping over the class divide and patronizing tea rooms filled with Jewish immigrants. Everyone would get drunk on heady arguments about politics and literature. Gradually, these college-educated visitors began moving downtown to the village to be closer to what they saw as a more authentic life. Interesting, but it's the second myth about Greenwich Village and its inhabitants that Stanzel dismantles that makes her book appealing to more than just a readership of us New York City history buffs. As colorful as the village bohemians were, and I mean that literally, since they favored decorating combinations like acid yellow and purple, they've always seemed sort of inconsequential, their sexual and political daring rendered quaint by the Roaring Twenties and the radical 1930s. Through careful and inspired research, however, Stanzel shows how the village bohemians helped shove America into the modern age. She discusses, most ingeniously, their elastic style of conversation, how the bohemians decided to talk their way into the future by opening up all topics for discussion. A weekly lineup of lectures at the liberal club in the village, Stanzel says, might have included a talk on the tango, followed by others on the wobblies, the slit skirt, nudism, and the music of Richard Strauss. And as Stanzel demonstrates, those emancipated 1920s flappers would have been unimaginable were it not for the bohemians and their messy private experiments in free love, as well as their more public avowals of sexual equality for women. American Moderns is substantive, scholarly, and spicy. Though it's much less ambitious, it also serves as a wonderful preamble to Terrible Honesty, Anne Douglas's groundbreaking cultural history of New York City in the 1920s. And like Douglas's book, American Moderns is unintentionally but inevitably wistful. How could it be otherwise? Reading about these fervent young bohemians, I thought about a poster advertising some political rally that I saw on my own college campus last week. "Care about something," it implored student passersby. That poster would have been incomprehensible to the Greenwich Village bohemians in the first decades of this century. They seemed to care passionately and sometimes foolishly about everything.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed American Moderns, Bohemian New York, and the Creation of a New Century. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Schirach. Our program was directed by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Guru.com. Guru.com, staffing short-term projects in a variety of fields, including creative, technology, marketing, and strategy. Guru.com. From Random House's Delta Division, publisher of The Times of My Life and My Life with the Times, by Max Frankel of The New York Times. And from Island Records' Def Jam Music Group, featuring I Am Shelby Lynn, from new recording artist Shelby Lynn. Available in stores or on the web, www.islanddefjam.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Why are we here? What's life all about?
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Eric Idle performs some of the comic songs he wrote during his days with Monty Python. He has a new CD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Tonight, it's the meaning of life. Oh, what's the point of all these hoax? Is it the chicken?